My topic this evening is the end of the matter. And I thought the best way to start is just say the end. The most things that we know of, that everything that begins, not everything, but most things have an end. Every movie we watch, every TV show we watch, it has an end. Very end says the end. Our fiction novels that we read, the last page, what does it say? It says the end. Every song we listen to has a beginning, it has an end. Whether it fades away or it ends on a note, it has an end. We begin our education, our school at pre-K or kindergarten, and then we make it through high school, an end. In our culture, we turn 18. That marks the end of adolescence, another end. And we have all kinds of sayings. And these, I thought of some of these, and I thought, these are pretty funny. I'm sure that y'all might know of some more. But we say things like, all good things come to an end. We call it a day. We throw in the towel. Turn the page. Bite the dust. Pull the plug. Kick the bucket. We hang it up, or maybe we say it ran its course. And the end even has some different meanings from a different context. We have a dead-end road. You have, I think we've all heard the preacher example of when we talk about traditions, about the woman who they ask, well, why do you cut the ends off of your ham before you put it into the, well, you have the ends of a ham that you cut off. So we have all kinds of things, and we say the end. But sometimes it's a way of expressing a goal or a reason, a main point. We say something like, to what end? We say, to this end. Paul uses this in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9. He says, for to this end I also wrote. And in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 11, he says, to this end we also pray for you. And while they all have different meanings that are nuanced a little bit, depending on that context, the idea is always the same. Things are until they aren't. You know, you have the rear end of a car. It's the car until the end, and then it's not anymore. It's somebody else's car, or it's the air, or whatever. But things are until they aren't. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. That will come to an end in 2 Peter chapter 3, 11, 10 and 11. For most of us on this earth, and I say that because there may be some of us remaining when Christ returns, we're all going to die and then face the judgment. An end. And for those people who are here when Christ returns, it's going to be an end in and of itself. But in Ecclesiastes, Solomon devotes a great deal of attention to the end. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 2 says, a time to give birth and a time to die. The end of life. Again, in verse 20, he says, we'll return to the dust. Another end of life. In Ecclesiastes 7, verse 8, better is the end of a matter than the beginning. But our text this evening, ironically, comes at the chronological end of Ecclesiastes. And contextually here, the end is the point, the conclusion that was drawn. And it comes from Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, which reads, this is the end of the matter, all hath been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment with every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. But before we jump into our text, I want to take a little time to look at Solomon. What brought Solomon to this statement? Solomon in his life, you'll recognize the great fall with Solomon. And it's one big thing that I think we need to address in a moment, and it may seem like a side point, but we'll come back to it later. But whenever we get to it, you'll see the big picture and understand why I brought it up. When you look at Ecclesiastes as a whole, it's hard to read without recognizing the undertone of regret. He has a regret for a life wasted, a life that he wished would have been spent another way. I think most of us would look and say, you know, we have some regrets. We have some things that we wish we wouldn't have wasted our time on. When I was in my 20s, I looked back at my teenage years and thought, you know, what was I thinking? Why was I anxious about these things? Why did I care what these people thought? And then I get to my 20s and my 30s, and I was like, well, why am I anxious about this and that? And then I come to in my 40s, mid-40s, and I look at it and say, you know, I'm making better decisions now, but, you know, there's still some decisions I wish I would have made different. So I think we can all kind of understand from a standpoint as to why did Solomon write what he wrote? Why did he come to the end? And this is, most scholars think this Ecclesiastes was written at the end of his life. Why would we think he would come to this time and say, you know, all vanity? Why would he be so reflective on those things? But while Ecclesiastes isn't specifically dealing with regret of sin, it is reflective of searching for meaning in things and happiness outside of God, which in and of itself can be sinful. Turn, if you will, to 1 Kings chapter 9. We're going to start with a promise that's made to Solomon. He's going to give us a promise and a warning. Beginning in verse 3, says, "And Yahweh said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me. I have set apart as holy this house which you have built by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness, to do according to all I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. Just as I promised to your father David, saying, you shall not have a man cut off from the throne of Israel. But if your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments as my statutes, which I have given before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them. In the house which I have set apart as holy for my name, I will cast out of my presence, so Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will feel desolate and hiss and say, why has Yahweh done thus to the land and to this house? And they will say, because they forsook Yahweh their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and took hold of other gods and worshiped them and served them before Yahweh. Or therefore Yahweh has brought all this calamity on them." So he's a king. He built the house of God, the temple. He's a king who asked for and received greater wisdom than anyone had ever had. If you continue in verse 9, or in verse 10 rather, says in it, I've got the wrong thing in here. Well, we'll go on. It says, "So give your slave a listening heart to judge, your people to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this glorious people of yours?" And it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing, and God had said to him, "Because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have you have asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to listen to justice, behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. Now, if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments, as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days." So In 1 Kings 4, 29 through 30, we see God granting Solomon's request. It says, "And he gave Solomon wisdom and great discernment and breadth of understanding in his heart, like the sand that is in the seashore, and Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt." So he had wisdom. He had wisdom of earthly things, things that were practical, things that we look at now and acknowledge, hey, those are necessary for us to make a living. How to grow food, how to raise animals. And the same chapter in verse 33 and 34, it says, "And he spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish, and men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom." Can you imagine having all the wisdom, when you think about Solomon, all the wisdom that he had, can you imagine having all of that to where you could make the right decision every time? Surely we would never make the wrong choice if we had the knowledge of Solomon. And I hope you can catch the sarcasm in that, because what happens? Well, after receiving all of his wisdom, all of his knowledge, in 1 Kings 11, Solomon decides to rebel against God's law, and all that wisdom that should have told him otherwise, he decides to go and take wives from adulterous nations. In chapter 11, verse 1 of 1 Kings, it says, "Now Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which Yahweh said to the sons of Israel, 'You shall not go along with them, nor shall they go along with you. For they will surely turn your hearts away, or your heart away after their gods.' Solomon clung to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away." Now it happened at the time that Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after the Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites, and Solomon did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and did not follow Yahweh fully as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So in all of his wisdom, he ignored God's marriage commandments, and it cost him dearly. Later on in the history of Israel, in the time of Ezra, this was serious enough that they split their families up because of that same sin. And I know there in this group, there's many of you, and a lot of us are affected by having a spouse who may not have been godly at the time. And there's many of you who've brought your spouse to Christ, and that's wonderful. That's a testament to the gospel and a testament to you as an individual. But unfortunately, you're the minority. You're the exception to the rule. We don't really worry about our spouses taking us off into idolatry like they did in the time of Israel. But we do have to acknowledge that there's an influence that our spouses and the people around us play in our lives. They can pull us away from having a passion from God that we should have. I know as parents, we pray, or we should pray, that our children find spouses and have friends that are godly people, that they're people they should associate with. We understand that bad company corrupts good morals, as it states in 1 Corinthians 15:33. Of Solomon, it was said in 1 Kings 11:4 that his wives turned his heart away after other gods. When we look at the importance of spiritual things in our lives, which is really the crescendo of Ecclesiastes in chapter 12, I think Solomon's choices here are something that we have to look at. Why did Solomon seek to find purpose in life, in all the things that he would eventually call vanity? He had everything he could have asked for. He had wealth, he had power, he had wisdom. Everything that was given to him by God. And in the end, he simply reduces it to vanity. And I'm going to ask a lot of questions in this lesson, but do we allow the people in our lives to bring us closer to God or push us away? Are they enablers or do they sharpen us? As Proverbs 27:17 states, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But for some of us, it's not a spouse. It's not a close friend. We've probably got good friends and close spouses that are good, godly people. But it could be a pursuit like a job, education, politics. I know there's a lot of people who love politics above all things. Maybe it's our preferences or our opinions. That's a hard one for a lot of us. The list goes on and on, but I'm going to put a pin right here, and we're going to come back to this later as we conclude, but not yet. But as we work through the text, I want to look, and you'll see that the broad point will be evident, and it should give us pause when we think about what it took to bring a God-fearing king to this point. Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, if you'll turn there. It's going to begin in a rather abrupt way. But we need to begin in verse 9 to start, and we'll follow our text down as we go. In verse 9, just as he does in chapter 1, he calls himself the preacher, and he'll speak of other writings and discourses, probably referring to the book of Proverbs. He was not simply wise for his own benefit. He was an educator of wisdom, and he was a writer. He shows his desire that the things that he writes are true and upright. He calls them delightful words, not because they're pleasing to hear, but because they're true to life. I know a lot of times we like to be around people who will, be real, and they'll tell us the way things are. Sometimes we like that, sometimes we don't. Sometimes it's hard to get some feedback from individuals, and sometimes that's good. But I can see a lot of this in Solomon's writing in Ecclesiastes. He says a lot of things, and they're not necessarily pleasant to hear, but they're things you need to hear. They're things that he's going to go on to say, they're words of wise men to the one shepherd. In verse 11, he calls them well-driven nails. In other words, they hit the nail on the head. That's how we like to say it. But moving on in verse 12, he makes a big warning, and I think we have to keep that in its context. It says, the making of many books is endless, and much devotion to books is wearying to the flesh. Now, I say that being somebody who I have a whole lot of books, a whole lot of Bible books. I have a lot of Bibles, as Marty was talking about it, my Bibles. But this isn't talking about spiritual learning. This isn't talking about, you're just learning too much about God here. You need to stop that. This is, when does learning for the sake of learning become a problem? When is it just chasing the idea of learning? You can think of a lot of degrees and things that people go and they spend a lot of money and take out loans to go to college to get degrees that they'll never use or will never really benefit anything. Those things happen, and those are just learning for the sake of learning. But when he comes to verse 13, he slams on the brakes. He'll come to a complete stop. We'll see 3 points that he's going to make in verses 13 and 14. But first, we see the past pursuits of Solomon, drawing a conclusion from all the previous writing in Ecclesiastes that has been done. So many of these are pursuits that a lot of us have been involved in at one time or another. Maybe they're not sinful, working hard, working outside, trying to do things for your family, certainly not sinful, but he brings all these things to an end, and he says, the end of the matter, all has been heard. What's the matter? What has been heard? Solomon has pursued it all, money, power, pleasure, knowledge. He has spent a lengthy time telling us the futility of all of it to bring us to this point. So he's drawing a conclusion, as some translations will say. I know I think the New King James says, this is the conclusion of the matter, all has been heard. But he's basically saying, here's the point. I've said all that to say this. Solomon lived it, therefore you don't have to waste your time. Whatever you thought you would find, it isn't these things. He calls them vain over and over. What was it, 18 times that he says the vain, this is vain. Work is vain, knowledge is vain, pleasure is vain, power is vain, riches and possessions are vain, pride is vain. Some of these things, like I said, are not in and of themselves sinful, but in the grand scheme of things, they don't have any value in eternity. Do we ever look back at our past pursuits as vanity? I think most of us would. We'd go back and say, that was worthless. That was something I shouldn't have bothered with. Do we look back maybe wishing that we could go back and relive those moments over again? That can go both positive or negative. Can we go back and change something? Do we wish, hey, I wish I would have done it differently? Or, man, I sure love that sin I was involved in. I sure wish I could go back and relive those moments. That's a question to ponder, and I hope that we can look at those things and say, I'm going to move forward from that point and serve God. But we are going to move forward, and we're going to look at the present purpose of man, which is to fear God. So Jamie Beller did a great job a few weeks ago talking about the fear of the Lord. So I'm not going to go deep into this, but like I normally do when I do lessons, I'm going to ask some questions for our own benefit. But fear most commonly is defined as reverence and awe in the Bible. We don't really use those two words outside of this context. I can't think of a time, maybe awe a little bit, but we don't usually use the word reverence outside of being in a church building usually. We usually say something like, amazement, respect and amazement, something like that. That's what we normally get at. But they don't quite hit the same like the term reverence and awe. But things we're in awe of and things that we revere are things that we take seriously. Patriotism, while it's generally become a political issue for a lot of people, you know, people who love the United States generally have a certain amount of reverence for it. What do we do with our flag? We have attention to detail. When you go to a funeral of a veteran, usually there's a great deal of detail that goes on in that flag ceremony. When they're folding that flag, it means something. It has a solemn a meaning, whereas other things might not. We have that silence, and we have the hand over our heart. Hats are off when we sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Doesn't our God deserve at least that same amount of reverence and awe that we have for political things and for patriotism, our country? I think our Creator should at least get that much reverence. He is the God that created everything, and Him being that Creator, He's worthy of our praise and worship. And Him being the Creator, He has the right to make demands of us. He's our provider. He's worthy of our gratitude. He's our Savior. And being our Savior, He's worthy of our worship, our gratitude, and our obedience. And I think if you need convinced of that, you need to take a read through the Psalms. I don't think you'd have to look too deep to see the theme of the Psalms being that God is worthy of praise and thanksgiving and worship and obedience. But some questions. Do we take Him seriously as we worship? How about our preparation for worship? Do we take Him seriously then? Do I take Him seriously when I work at my job or go to school during the week? Right now I'm off of my job so I can come speak tonight. But when I go back, am I going to take God seriously in the way that I treat people, in the way that my example is, and how I'm going to talk to people? Am I going to take God seriously in that? When you go to school, are you going to be involved in things and all kinds of mischief that is not going to show God for who He is? In my marriage, as a husband or a wife, am I showing the respect and awe for God? Am I taking God seriously and what God has asked me to do as a husband or as a wife or as a parent? How about as a child? Do we take our role seriously? How about in my entertainment choices? How I dress? Do I take Him seriously in how I speak? how I speak about him. I know that some of y'all are probably struggling through me saying Yahweh in the text. All it is all caps Lord in most of the other translations, or Jehovah in some of the older translations. But do I take him seriously in how I speak? Do I make jokes about God? Do I make jokes about sin? How do I talk about his church? Do I take him seriously in those things? I know it's a struggle sometimes on the ride home. Boy, that preacher this morning, I tell you what. Maybe tonight when you leave, boy, that guy. How about my brother or my sister? Both the ones at home and the ones here. How do I take God seriously? God has said a lot about how I'm supposed to talk and interact with my brother and sister. Do I take those things seriously? Do I take his word seriously? So God's spoken on all those things, and he's dealt with all those questions through commandments, through examples, through principles. But I'll ask, what drives me in my day-to-day life? Is it the world, or is it my fear of God? So we're to fear God, and the next part of that is to keep his commandments. This one was a real struggle because I know in our religious context what this can go through, the idea of keeping commandments. It's an unpopular thought in our day, and likely in Solomon's day, but obedience. People seek the God of live and let live because I believe he exists. Nothing I do matters to him. How many of you have ever heard the statement, and it usually comes right after you say, hey, I saw you do that. That wasn't something that you should do. And they would say something like, God knows my heart. Usually it's after that, but it's the idea that what I do doesn't matter as long as what's in my heart is right. And I don't think that's always the flex that we might think it is. What does it really say whenever that's my defense? Well, God knows my heart. God probably knows that you weren't paying attention to his word, or that you didn't care what he had to say. We're basically saying, God, I don't care what you told me to do. Just look at my heart. It'll say exactly that. It'll say that you don't care. It says, I have no fear of you. Jesus said, for out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, sexual immoralities, thefts, false witness, slanders. A lot of those things that the false witness and slanders we might have struggles with when we're talking about our brothers and sisters, our families. Those are things that are brought up here. But what's in your heart will come out. Keeping God's commandments does matter. In John 14:15, he says, if you love me, keep my commandments. It's not just mindlessly doing actions that are contained in Scripture, but because of your faith, your fear of God, your love for him, that you'll willingly give yourself over to his will, his request, his demands. Notice how it doesn't say this. If you keep my commandments, you love me. I know there's a struggle there for a lot of people that if I just do this, it means I'm faithful. It doesn't always mean that, because you have to have that fear of God. Fear of God and love will create the proper motivation, because it becomes obedience. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 3 we read, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. So what do we do here? We don't treat the commandments of God as impossible. They're not, when it says burdensome, it's saying they're not, if you say they're burdensome, you're saying it's too hard for me. God didn't give us anything that was too hard. We don't react in disappointment just because we can't do what we want to do, or because we don't want to do what he tells us to do. Is it hard sometimes? Yeah, it is. Is it impossible? No, it's not impossible, but sometimes it's very hard. Additionally, I think we need to talk about whether, you hear this a lot, when people say, you need to keep the commandments of God. Well, you're legalistic. We should never take a command from God saying, keep my commandments. We should never look at it and say, that's legalistic. We shouldn't do that. If I'm expecting a result or a reward from God for simply doing things without faith, without love, without fear of God, then yes, we might be on the legalistic side. But doing what God says because of who he is and my love for him is not, that's not legalism, that's obedience. And it's an it's the expectation of all of us who confess Christ. Do we fail? Often. Do we sin? Yeah. But that's why we have the blood of Jesus, 1 John chapter 1 and verse 9. We are called to be a higher, we're called to a high standard because we are to be the light of the world and not a stumbling block to the world. After all, we fear him because of who he is, and he has the right to require our obedience, not by just doing the things that he tells us to do, not by not doing the things that he tells us not to do, but by doing the things that he tells us to do as well. How do we do with that? A lot of the times we're good with, well, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that, I'm not doing this. Yes, but are you doing X, Y, Z over here? He tells us to do that. Those are commandments. We're to do those things. I would say if we made a list of the top 5 or 10 most neglected commandments in our lives, I think those things that we aren't doing that we should be would be right on top. How about love your enemies? How about sharing the truth? How about giving as we've been prospered? We can go on and on. I mean, we should never be doing the things that God tells us not to do, but he doesn't leave us hanging at any point. Just because I'm not doing the works of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5 doesn't mean that I'm pleasing to God if I don't replace them with the fruit of the Spirit. He never leaves us in a vacuum. He always gives us something to put in its place. And I think about this often, but wouldn't we have a whole lot less trouble in our lives if we would just do what God tells us to do and focus on those things, because those things aren't going to push us into the things that we shouldn't be doing, the things that he tells us not to do. And I got to rush here because we're getting behind. But he gives us a purpose. It's not simply not getting dirty, but serving him with reverence and awe. Sometimes we act like a horse sticking our neck through a fence to reach the grass on the other side, rather than just eating out in the field that he's given to us. The last part of our verse, in verse 13, it says, for this is the whole duty of man. You're probably going to have a lot of variations in your English Bible. So I think Marty started to bring this up a little bit a few weeks ago. But many of you, you'll see italics here. Maybe it's just the word duty. That's the way it is in the King James, the American Standard Version. The ESV reads the same way, but it doesn't have italics to show you that the translators have inserted those words. But in other translations, like the New American Standard, it'll say, for this applies to every man. The NIV has the duty of all mankind. But when you take into account the general context here, how does Ecclesiastes come to an end? What are we talking about? I think rather than saying that everyone's just supposed to do this, the point is rather that this is man's purpose on the earth, is to fear God and keep his commandments. So I don't really think the italics really help us. So without the italics, if you just drop that word duty, it says this is the whole of man. In other words, this is man's essence, his purpose. It belongs to God. The New King James will render this verse, this is man's all. And I think it really grabs the meaning of the verse here. But at the end of the day of your life, you could say you had one job, and that was fear God and keep his commandments. Whatever you do in life, you fear God and you keep his commandments. Are you a parent? Fear God and keep his commandments. Child, fear God and keep his commandments. Are you a boss? What are you going to do? Fear God and keep his commandments. Are you an employee? Fear God and keep his commandments. No matter where you are, what you do, how old you are, fear God and keep his commandments. That's what you're created for. This is more of a God-first mentality. In Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. These things, the things that all of that wisdom was used for, the how do I grow food? How do I work hard? All these things. Well, I'm providing for my family. What are these things? Those are the things that God said they'll be added to you if you seek him first. A lot of times we're chasing luxuries and not just these things that Jesus spoke of. And that's not to say that we need to be preachers. We don't all have to be preachers, but we need to fear God and keep his commandments in what we do as we go through our daily lives. The Apostle Paul was a tent maker. That was his secular job, but what did he do with it? Well, he used it to preach the gospel. He used that to support his real pursuit. But back in 1 Kings 11, in verse 4, it is said of Solomon, his heart was not wholly or fully devoted to God. Can we afford a somewhat or mostly devoted life that's given to God? Can we do that, or does that just not cut it? I think we all need to look at ourselves to ensure where we need to be. Does your life show reverence and awe and the devotion to doing God's will that it should? It kind of reminds me of a lesson I did a few years ago at the fall retreat. It was for me to live as Christ and to die as gain. Paul here is basically saying, no matter what happens, I'm going to serve Christ. If I live, I'm going to be preaching the gospel. I'm going to be doing what God has me to do. If I die, I'm going to go be with Christ. Either way, his life was wholly devoted to serving God. But why does it all matter? Solomon finishes Ecclesiastes with this answer. It's his third and final point. It's a future reality for mankind. God will bring every work into judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. And I don't know how many top 10 lists I've made in this lesson so far, but if I were making a top 10 list of the most terrifying passages in all of Scripture, this one would be pretty close to the top. Everything I do, he sees. Everything I say, he hears. Everything I think, he knows. And Paul echoes this statement in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and verse 5. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in darkness and make manifest the motives of the heart. Do we always want God to see the motives of our heart, or do we sometimes have to make a change there? Sometimes I think it's terrifying to know what God knows about what I think and what's in my heart. He's going to repeat the sentiment in chapter 2, or in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10, says, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. And then John comes in, not to be outdone, but he's a little more positive whenever he goes about saying it in 1 John chapter 3. He says, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing in his sight. So God knows our heart. Our heart can condemn us. He will bring every work into judgment. And we have to give an account for our good deeds and our bad. The things I've done, the things I haven't done. And I'm right on time. As we conclude, Solomon's reminder is this: when all is said and done, the only thing that will matter in this life was, did I fear God and keep his commandments? Did I live a life that was wholly devoted to him? In our culture, when you look at things that are considered important, what really matters is whether or not I'm wholly devoted to God. What stands in my way? Pleasure, possessions, power, pride? Is it a person that you're worried about pleasing rather than pleasing God? Maybe it's nothing. Maybe nothing stands in your way. Nothing is something, though. I heard a lecture a few weeks ago, and the statement was made that the only thing necessary to drift away is nothing. And that was in the context of just life in general and leadership and things like that. But I thought to myself, what would that mean spiritually if I just did nothing and that nothing could make me drift away? What does that look like? It looks like no prayer. It looks like no study. It looks like no service, no worship, no growth, no thought for spiritual things. Or maybe it's nothing more. Maybe it's, well, I'm not going to do any extra. I'm not going to do any more than what I'm doing now. But if it isn't toward fearing God and keeping his commandments, what stands in your way? Unfortunately for Solomon, all of it stood in his way. He wasted his time and effort on vain things. He tried to please his wives rather than fearing God. He was punished for his actions. We know that in 1 Kings 11, verses 9 through 14, there are several. He gives all of these ones that were raised up to... as adversaries to him. And in that, there's a lot of lessons to be learned. What could God raise up as an adversary for us in the end? But I want to end just with our main thought. We're going to all stand before the judgment one day. The end has been heard, or all has been heard. The end of the matter is what? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. Thank you.
Well, not bad for an introvert, don't you think? Besides, he wears cool shirts. What's that? I wish I had kept track how many questions we heard tonight that were thought-provoking and probing into our spiritual thought processes. I like the technique of using those questions. And one point that especially hit me hard was contrasting 1 Kings 11, where he was talking about Solomon, his heart was not wholly with the Lord. And then we read the end of Ecclesiastes where he says, that's all there is to us, is fearing God and keep his commandments. That's the whole of man, and yet Solomon missed it. Bless his heart, I guess we would say in Oklahoma, but may we not follow those footsteps, but rather the other ones that lead us to the Lord. Thank you, John. We appreciate it. May God bless us all for being here, and you are dismissed.